This is Audible.
Command and Control. Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Accident, and the Illusion of Safety by Eric Schlosser. In January 1957, the Secretary of the Air Force, Donald A. Quarles, visited Sandia to attend briefings on the latest sealed pit weapons. Quarles left the meetings worried about the safety of the Genie, and he was unusually qualified to pass judgment. He'd served for 2 years as Assistant Secretary of Defense for Research and Development, helping to select new weapon systems, guiding the Pentagon's investment in new technologies, and contemplating the future of warfare. He'd also spent a year as President of Sandia, immersed in the minutiae of atomic bombs. Small, wiry, brilliant, and intense, a high school graduate at the age of 15 who later studied math and physics at Yale, Quarles felt the weight of his job, his place at the very epicenter of the arms race. He rarely took vacations and could often be found at his Pentagon office late into the night, 6 or 7 days a week. Only a handful of people understood, as well as Quarles did, how America's nuclear weapons worked and how the military planned to use them. Within weeks of the briefings for Quarles at Sandia, the Armed Forces Special Weapons Project created a safety board to scrutinize the design of every sealed pit weapon in development. The Air Force soon commissioned wide-ranging studies of whether a nuclear weapon could be detonated by accident. And in July 1957, Quarles asked the Atomic Energy Commission to conduct the nation's first comprehensive inquiry into the possibilities for increasing the safety of nuclear weapons. The AEC agreed to do it, and a team of Sandia engineers was given the lead role. One of the inquiry's first tasks was to compile a list of the accidents that had already occurred with nuclear weapons. The list would be useful for predicting not only what might happen to the new sealed pit designs in the field, but also the frequency of mishaps. The Department of Defense didn't always notify the AEC about nuclear weapon accidents, and a thorough accounting of them proved difficult to obtain. The Air Force eventually submitted a list of 87 accidents and incidents that had occurred between 1950 and the end of 1957. Sandia found an additional 7 that the Air Force had somehow neglected to include. Neither the Army nor the Navy submitted a list. They'd failed to keep track of their nuclear accidents. More than one-third of those on the Air Force list involved war reserve, atomic, or hydrogen bombs, weapons that could be used in battle. The rest involved training weapons, and all of the accidents shed light on the many unforeseeable ways that things could go wrong. An accident might be caused by a mechanical problem. On February 13, 1950, a B-36 bomber took off from Eielson Air Force Base, about 30 miles south of Fairbanks, Alaska. The crew was on a training mission, learning how to operate from a forward base near the Arctic. The weather at Eielson was windy and snowy, and the ground temperature had risen in the previous few hours. It was about minus 27 degrees Fahrenheit. Captain Harold L. Berry and 16 crew members had been fully briefed on the mission. Fly to Montana, turn around, go to Southern California, turn again, head north to San Francisco, simulate the release of a Mark IV atomic bomb above the city, and then land at a SAC base in Fort Worth, Texas. The mission would take about 20 hours. In the middle of the night, as the B-36 reached an altitude of 15,000 feet, it started to lose power. Ice had accumulated on the engines, as well as on the wings and propellers. The crew couldn't see the ice. Visibility was poor due to the darkness, cloud cover, and frost on the windows. But they could hear chunks of ice hitting the plane. It sounded like a hailstorm. Ice clogged the carburetors, 3 of the 6 engines caught fire, and the bomber rapidly lost altitude. Captain Berry managed to guide the plane over the ocean not far from Princess Royal Island in British Columbia, Canada. He ordered a co-pilot to open the bomb bay doors and dump the Mark IV. The doors were stuck and wouldn't open. The co-pilot tried again. The doors opened, and the Mark IV fell from the plane. Its high explosives detonated 3,000 feet above the water, and a bright flash lit the night sky. The bomb did not contain a nuclear core. Navigating solely by radar, Captain Barry steered the plane back toward land and ordered the crew to bail out. One of the co-pilots, Captain Theodore Schreier, mistakenly put on a life jacket over his parachute. He was never seen again. The first four men to jump from the plane also vanished, perhaps carried by the wind into the ocean. Captain Barry, the last to go, parachuted safely onto a frozen lake, hiked for miles through deep snow to the coast, and survived, along with the rest of his crew. The abandoned B-36 somehow flew another 200 miles before crashing on Vancouver Island. An accident could occur during the loading, unloading, or movement of weapons. On at least four occasions, the bridge wire detonators of Mark VI atomic bombs fired when the weapons were improperly removed from aircraft. They were training weapons, and nobody got hurt. But with the new sealed pit weapons, that sort of mistake would cause a full-scale nuclear detonation. At least half a dozen times, the carts used to carry Mark VI bombs broke away from the vehicles towing them. During one incident, the cart rolled into a ditch. Had it rolled in another direction, a classified report noted, a live MK-6 weapon would have plunged over a steep embankment. Dropping a nuclear weapon was never a good idea. Impact tests revealed that when the Genie was armed, it didn't need a firing signal to detonate. The Genie could produce a nuclear explosion just by hitting the ground. An accident could be made worse by the response. In the early days of the Korean War, amid fears that Japan and Taiwan might be attacked, a B-29 bomber prepared to take off from Fairfield Suisun Air Force Base in California. It was 10 o'clock at night. The mission was considered urgent, its cargo top secret. One of the 9 Mark IV atomic bombs being transferred to Guam at President Truman's request. The cores would be airlifted separately. Brigadier General Robert F. Travis sat in the cockpit as a high-level escort for the weapon.